Hello, I'm Adrian Wojnarowski, host of the Vertical Podcast with Woj, powered by digital media. I'm here in Memphis with Grizzlies coach David Fizdale, who started his professional basketball journey in the video room of the Miami Heat, holed up with Eric Spoelstra, the two of them imagining a day when they would both become head coaches in the NBA. Eventually, Fizdale would win two titles as a member of Spoelstra's Miami Heat coaching staff. And finally this year, at 42 years old, Fizdale was hired to run his own team, the Grizzlies. And so far, he's delivered a powerful performance, despite multiple injuries, an 18-9 record that has most of his coaching peers calling him easily the early front runner for NBA Coach of the Year. Fiz and I discussed his long journey from the crossfire of South Central LA, the fighting stereotypes often assigned to young African-American assistant coaches, to landing this head coaching job with Marc Gasol and Mike Conley in Memphis. Fiz remembers those early days in Miami with LeBron James, Chris Bosh, and Dwayne Wade, when, with a 9-8 record, Heat president Pat Riley visited the coaching office.
And Pat came down, he sat in the office with us, with Spo and I, and he smiled at us and he said, "I'm not coaching this damn team." He said, "I watch you guys work every single day, and you're doing everything you're supposed to do to build championship habits, and I like what I see." You know, obviously, Spo and I thought he was coming down to fire us that day, but it just felt great to know that he had our backs, you know, like that. And from that point on, we ended up winning 22 out of 23.
All this and a lot more with Memphis coach David Fizdale. Let's get to it. Here with David Fizdale, Memphis Grizzlies head coach. Fiz, how are you today, man?
I'm doing great. Thanks for being here.
Fiz, all the years you work with Eric Spoelstra and you work with Mike Woodson and you're part of an organization with Pat Riley, as great of a coach as the league's had, and everyone always tells you everything changes when you get in this seat. And in your time now in Memphis, in this short time, do you ever really appreciate as an assistant how many decisions go into every single day? Mm-hmm. How many people are looking to you every day at the facility? Do you have to be in this job to really understand how your life changes?
Yeah, you do. You really do. You know, when I was working for Spo, I was Mr. Suggestions. You know, I was throwing out suggestions left, right, 100 suggestions. And, you know, as an assistant, that's easy. Because, you know, that's your job, too, you know, to give them as many ideas as possible. But ultimately, when you take that seat, you start to understand how mindful you have to be and how thoughtful you have to be about every decision you make and or the decisions you don't make, the things you don't move on. You really have to take time to contemplate and think those things through, because you are the decision maker now, and those decisions have consequences. And so I've really tried to take that to heart. You know, I really learned from Spo from that standpoint, to, as the head coach, to be more mindful and to really put thought into every single decision I make.
You look at the young coaches in the league this year, assistants who became head coaches, Luke Walton with the mm-hmm. Lakers and Kenny Atkinson in Brooklyn, and you here, and you know, you and Kenny have been at it longer as assistants than perhaps Luke had. Mm-hmm. The common denominator, and I talked with Luke about this last week, it seems like, especially with the younger guys, you have got to build relationships mm-hmm. with your players. You've got to build trust. The day of the coach just standing there with his arms folded, dictating.
That's over. Well, at least for us, I think. You know, it's a different generation of kid. You know, for whatever reason, just beating them over the head and yelling at them and telling them do it because I say so, I think those days are slowly dwindling. I think it's much more of a generation of telling them why and explaining the why. This is why we do things the way we do them. This is why I make the decisions I make. This is why I want you to play the way I want you to play. And I think these kids respect you more because of that. And when you give them that information and you educate them on why you're doing certain things, I think it connects you closer to those kids, and you know, ultimately they play harder for you.
And Fiz, it seems like what maybe was a little bit unique about taking over here, usually when a new coach gets hired, he's taking over a job where there isn't really an identity, where you have to establish how a team's going to play. Because of Marc Gasol and Mike Conley and Zach Randolph and Tony Allen, there was an identity here of how this team plays and how it has success. What was it like? What's it been like to acknowledge that, use what was already in place, mm-hmm. but say, but here's how I'm going to add to it. Here's what I believe in that complements it. You didn't take a rebuild over.
No, and that was important to me. I really wanted to come to an organization that had already had some roots and some success established. I thought that it would be important, you know, no matter what job that I ended up getting, that I acknowledged what was already in place. And that if they had had success at something, that we didn't get too far away from that while at the same time evolving and growing the organization. So when I looked at the Memphis job and saw that it was available, you know, it's really the first job that I went after. And what I saw was an incredible grit and toughness built from coach to coach. That was a consistent thing that had passed on from coach to coach. And so to win a title, you have to have those ingredients. And so if I knew that I didn't have to instill that into this team, and I can just get these guys to understand that they can grow as players, they can evolve as players, and they can adapt at the same time bringing, you know, what I learned from a championship culture in Miami, that maybe it would give us a chance. And that's really all you can ask for in this league is a shot at it. And these players have really bought into what I'm trying to do, and it's been great.
Fizz, as we tape, 18-9, you played a significant stretch here without Mike Conley. I think any first-year coach would, if he told you in the preseason you'd be missing Mike for as many games you have, that'd be your record, you'd take it.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah. And I'm still pissed off about some of the losses we've had since he's been out. You know, I was really upset with our team that we lost in Toronto when we were close in that game and we let go of the rope. You know, in Cleveland the other night, I didn't think we brought a ferocity to that game, a competitive spirit to that game. And so it's just my makeup, and maybe I'm, you know, delusional, but I just think we should win every game. And, you know, that's something that Pat instilled in us in Miami, that your approach and your mindset is always the same, no matter who's on the court for you, that you go after the win no matter what. And so I've tried to make sure that these guys understand that that's how we do things here. And, you know, like you said, I've ever thought would be an 18-9 without Mike, without Chandler, Brandon Wright, all these guys, Vince Carter and James Ennis. No. You know, being realistic, no. But did I expect us to roll over and die? No. I expected us to stay competitive and stay in the fight and hold the fort. But these guys have exceeded that, and it's a testament to the players.
When you start in Miami as a video intern, which anybody who's moved up from that position has always kind of felt like there's two jobs in the NBA that you really learn the league from, in the video room and advanced scout. And mm-hmm. I remember as a young reporter sitting at Madison Square Garden down on the floor, and Eric Spoelstra sitting next to me, Lawrence Frank was an advanced scout at the time. Yeah. There were a lot of guys who became head coaches who, especially when you were not an ex-player, that's where you started. Mm-hmm. What did you learn in that video room in Miami? You, Eric Spoelstra, Adam Simon, who's still in the front office in Miami.
Well, we learned how to eat a lot of chicken wings and drink a lot of Coca-Colas, that's for sure. Both of those guys, I mean, they very close to me, obviously, but we learned work ethic. I mean, that was before the technology. You were doing everything deck to deck, you know, back then. That was the first thing you learned, is how to work, you know, how to show up every day, how to put in the time, what it took to be successful. But then you got to learn the league. You know, I watched those films. I did it with, you know, open eyes, and I tried to learn from every team that I watched, and from every player that I watched. And so all of the edits and all of the different cuts that we had to make a film, I really tried to educate myself about rosters, different systems. I tried to learn from the edits that I were doing. So if Stan Van Gundy assigned us to cut the film a certain way, I wanted to know why. You know, why would Coach Van Gundy want this defensive edit? What is he trying to get done with this edit? And so it was like a college crash course, you know, and the best thing that could have ever happened to me was going to Miami Heat's video room.
At that time, you sit in the moments, you talk about your dreams, what you want to be. Did you and Eric Spoelstra ever imagine being head coaches in the NBA. Did you never imagine it, or did you imagine it every day?
Every day. We talked about it all the time. We said, one of these days, we're going to be head coaches, and we're going to have our own teams. It was just a dream of both of ours, you know, to do it. And we knew we were a long ways away, obviously. But, you know, and it wasn't something that we had to have right away. We understood. Both of us have the same makeup. We weren't in a hurry. We just wanted to work at it. But we talked about it, you know, from time to time of, you know, one day, you know, we'll get our own teams. I didn't think it would be at this age, and I don't think Spo thought his would happen as fast as it did. But when Spo got his job, it was no doubt in my mind he was ready. I mean, I'll put him up against anybody from a work ethic standpoint, from a guy who's willing to evolve and get uncomfortable and learn. I just knew that he was going to be a head coach, and a great one at that, one day. And then, you know, obviously riding his coattails all the way to four title runs, it gave me some pedigree and now an opportunity to have my own team.
You came back to Miami as on Eric's staff as an assistant. You had been in, you had some college assistant jobs, and then with Mike Woodson in, well, Golden State, and then with Mike Woodson in Atlanta on his staff. At the very beginning then, there was going to be resistance. You were going to maybe coach the group, coach LeBron in a way that maybe he hadn't been coached before. And there was resistance initially. The mindset in the coach's office every day, especially when he got off to a sluggish start, the way it's always been described to me, that there was really a fearlessness about that group with Eric, that we aren't going to be afraid to do this the way we think is right. What do you remember about that period in time when people were wondering, hey, is Pat going to come downstairs and coach this team?
I was lucky enough. I had gotten 2 years under my belt with Dwayne and Udonis before we got the big three. And I had established incredible relationships with them. So that helped me by the time that we got LeBron and Chris and those other veteran guys to establish a rapport, you know, right out the gate. And so, you know, once LeBron walked in, Dwayne had already talked to him, hey, Fizz is going to be the guy that's going to work with you, and just know that he's going to coach you. He's not going to care about, you know, what you've done before. And so the one thing that made us fearless was that we knew what LeBron was coming for. He wasn't coming to be a part of something where people were appeased, you know, and just tried to be yes man to him and let him do whatever he wanted to do. He was coming there to learn how to win. You know, we felt like we understood that. And, you know, I'll never forget the day. You know, we really, it's funny, people think we met resistance with that group. We really didn't. We just got off to a slow start. We just couldn't figure it out offensively on, you know, who was going to take that shot and how to get the ball moving and things like that and really get them to understand how to share the game. But it wasn't a lot of resistance. Like, that was one of the greatest training camps I've ever been a part of when we went out to that military base. And, you know, we were 9-8. I'll never forget it. Pat came down. All of this chatter was Pat's coming out of the front office to, and Pat came down. He sat in the office with us, with Spo and I, and he smiled at us and he said, I'm not coaching this damn team. He said, I watch you guys work every single day and you're doing everything you're supposed to do to build championship habits. And I like what I see. And, you know, obviously Spo and I thought he was coming down to fire us that day, but it just felt great to know that he had our backs, you know, like that. And from that point on, we ended up winning 22 out of 23 and all of the chatter went away. But, you know, to have that kind of support from and I think Pat being a coach, you know, before seeing that we were doing the necessary things to make the team play well, he understood it, you know, and so he didn't panic while everyone else was expecting instant results and, you know, this team to just get out of the gate and play great. He understood that it was going to be a process with them. And he never, ever wavered. And, you know, to this day, it's just his fortitude was unbelievable. I still look back on that and go, I don't even know if I could have been so, you know, calm in that moment. And he just had our backs and he said, I'm not coaching this team. He said, you guys are coaching this team and I like what I see and you guys will be just fine. He said, it'll break for you soon. And unbelievably, we went on an incredible run after that. And, you know, the rest was history.
And I think people, that's textbook on how it's supposed to work, that management tells the coach, I've got your back. Yep. The message to the players is, if you got a problem, don't come up to my office.
Right.
Go talk to your coach.
Yep.
But you also know what goes on in other places sometimes, and it what maybe breaks at the fabric of it is
right.
Players know they can go around the coach, whether it's the GM, the president, or even the owner. Mm-hmm. What did you learn about the need for that support, that structure in Miami that sort of maybe colors how you view the way it's got to go for you here?
It's the only chance you have of winning a title. If there's any fractures in the relationship, where there's a lack of trust or anything like that, where the communication is not fluid and you're not on the same page, you don't have a chance right out the gate before the ball ever is thrown up. You know, a big part of our success in Miami, and I'm sure it's in San Antonio and the places that win big, is there's an organizational philosophy on how to do things, you know, from top to bottom, from bottom to top. And that was the really joyous part of it, is when we did win it, it was all of us that won it. And we knew that we all had a little piece of it, and how we did things mattered, you know. And so coming here, that was a big part of why, you know, when I met with those guys in the interview process, and then finally when we got to a point of saying I'm going to be the head coach, you know, what we was talking about earlier is that I wanted them to understand, I don't want to do the front office job. I just want to coach this team. And, you know, I like to be included in discussions about personnel, but I don't want to have the final say on it. That's not my job. My job is to just coach. And, you know, I've seen a lot of coaches crumble and lose their jobs over trying to, you know, meddle in front office affairs when it's not their job. Now, I get it when your title is, you know, GM or president, and that's part of your responsibility. But I didn't want to be that coach that you know, fails because I'm, you know, butting heads with the front office over things. And they understood exactly where I was coming from. They understood my vision as a coach. They gave me their template of how they wanted to build the team. And once we all got on the same page, you know, I felt very good about the fact that we were going to have a very fluid, open relationship, you know, from top to bottom. And it's been great. I mean, these guys have included me in every decision without me forcing anything on them. They understand that the players need to go through me with a lot of the stuff that they're disgruntled about. If there is some guys that's upset about their situation. But I also understand that they need to go to the front office when it comes to contractual stuff and things like that. And so we are all on the same page. And I think it just at least gives us a chance to be in the conversation and to move forward towards a title.
Fizz, when you're an assistant coach and you're hopeful to be a head coach in the league, perception's interesting in this league of how people view you, because no one really knows what's going on in your organization, especially mm-hmm. Miami, where
right.
there's not a lot of sharing of information out mm-hmm. of the Heat organization to other people. Pat, you know, he's got relationships around the league, but he may not be out there always talking about his staff, and he's focused on Miami winning. Mm-hmm. Were you curious how people viewed you or what they thought your role was? And am I being seen as a head coaching candidate? Here was an organization that was winning at the highest level. You were in the finals, you're winning championships. And typically, those are the places that are feeding head coaches into the league, but yet there really wasn't an Eric Spoelstra tree yet in the NBA.
Right. And, you know, it was moments where my ego may have gotten the best of me, you know, and some times where I was alone. But, you know, luckily I was raised by a mom who understood, you know, what hard work brings. And, you know, she just told me, she said, no matter what job you have, you do that job as well as you could possibly do it. And the karma of that will work out for you, you know. And so I've always tried to live by that. You know, I never look forward to another job when I have a job to do where I'm at. And so what I tried to do in Miami was just, you know, keep my head down. You know, I didn't want my name put out there in every job and, you know, shop myself for every job. And I just wanted to work hard. I wanted to win. That was my biggest thing. And, you know, it came up, like people have talked about it, like Portland, you know, asked for permission when they had the opening to talk to me. And I just was very honest with Neil. And I said, you know, as long as these guys are here, the big three, and, you know, we're on this run, I'm going to ride it out. You know, because it was a special time, and you just don't have that many opportunities to be a part of something like that. You know, LeBron and Dwayne came to me after the second title and said, all right, you got to go. and I said, are you leaving? And they said, nope. And I said, well, I'm not leaving either. I said, as long as you guys are here and we're on this run, I want to be a part of this, you know, because just when I look back on my life, I want to say that I was a part of a legacy. And I do feel like that we built something special there. You know, a lot of times I know a lot of people don't want to talk about that Heat team anymore, you know, because things have changed and passed. But it was a special time in the NBA. You know, we were villains and then we were beloved and we won some incredible games. You know, Ray Allen provided us with a memory that I don't know if anyone will ever forget. And, you know, I'm glad I stayed. And the things I got to experience, you know, as an assistant, you know, from a learning experience, you know, game sevens and, you know, going through some tough losses and having to pick your guys back up and watching Spo do all of this stuff to keep the team hungry. Reinventing the team and things like that. You know, I learned a lot under those guys. And so I never tried to look forward or wonder what people were thinking about me. I just really tried to be a part of what I was involved in and work really hard. And, you know, at some point my time would come and it worked out great.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj.
And now a message from Capital One. Capital One knows you've got questions about your credit. You may be asking, who's really in charge of my credit score? Or how does my credit actually work? That's why Capital One created the CreditWise app, so you can check your credit score anytime you want, right in the app. And it's free to everyone, Capital One customer or not. In fact, millions of CreditWise users have improved their score by 20 points or more. So download the app for free today. Availability depends on presence of credit history from TransUnion. CreditWise is offered by Capital One Bank, USA, NA.
Fizz, you know, some African-American assistants, in talking to them and even hear executives talk about what their perception is, and maybe sometimes there's this stereotype that younger assistants or assistant coaches have to deal with, which is, well, he's the relationship guy.
Oh, I'm so tired of hearing that.
Right? Instead of, no, I'm a coach who's paid my dues, who's right. Tactically sound, who's game planned, but people maybe sometimes want to box you in. Did you hear that? Did you feel it? Did you think at times you had to, that it existed, that just the generalization?
Oh, for sure. And for sure. When they bring you in, you know, right away, you're the coach that has to get close to guys. Because you can communicate to him, and you're the one that's supposed to talk him off the ledge when he's ready to kill the coach and babysit him and do all of these things. And you get boxed into that. You know, when, you know, I look at one of my assistants, JB Bickerstaff, he's kind of followed the same track as I have, you know, from that standpoint. And yeah, is he great at communicating with guys and building relationships with guys? Yeah, but he's a tactician. He's a preparation junkie. You know, this guy works his tail off. He knows his X's and O's. And, you know, I think sometimes that's all they say is he can build great relationships. In fact, when I first got this job, that's all people said. Oh, he's great with relationships. Well, I can coach a little bit too, you know, and it's more to this than just being able to just say I can talk a guy off the ledge or be his friend. You know, it wasn't pleasant with LeBron and Dwayne and Chris every day, you know, to get them to work at the level I want them to work at or work on what I thought they needed to work on. You know, we butted heads often, you know, but the fact that I wouldn't back down and that I had evidence to show them, you know, this is why we're doing something, you know, that's outside of relationships. That's going into a whole nother realm of coaching. And, you know, that frustrated me more than anything is that that's all people saw me as was the guy that just kept everybody happy. You know, I worked my tail off from a, you know, scouting standpoint and from a studying standpoint. And, you know, I tried to be out of the box with a lot of stuff in player development and system development. And, you know, also, you know, learning analytics and technology, like, I really took pride in learning all of that stuff, but I kept getting pigeonholed as this guy who just, oh, he's a relationships guy. And I think that happens more often to African-American coaches because our league is more African-American. And, you know, I think that happens to a lot of these young coaches around the league. You got guys like Lloyd Pierce and David Vanderpool, you know, obviously, like I said, JB Bickerstaff, all of these guys, they're more than that. You know, I work with them at Gerbs camp in the summer and I coach against them and I talk basketball with them. These guys know their stuff And so, you know, if anything can change in this league, I would hope that that would change so these guys can start getting more opportunities to be leaders of organizations instead of just parts of organizations.
And I think, too, you and Mike Brown, to an extent, you know, University of San Diego guys.
Yeah.
But when people think of the and I want to say you were a non-player. You did beat Steve Nash.
Yeah, I led the conference.
You led the conference at WCC when you were at San Diego and he was at Santa Clara. But the guys like Spo, who played at University of Portland, you know, played at the WCC, were not, you know, Jeff Van Gundy, Stan, they played.
Yeah.
But not
NBA players.
Not NBA players. But you mentioned Lloyd Pierce, who actually played with, and David Vanderpool, who played in the CBA for a long time, played in Russia, that the perception people always had of that the African-American coach wasn't the guy coming up in the video room. And you guys have started to
changing that,
obliterate that. That I think there's a lot of guys, I think assistants are always pulling for it. When an assistant gets a job, there's no one happier in the league. The guys you just mentioned, they're all rooting for you because
no doubt.
If you have success in a job, it makes other organizations look at, well, maybe we hire an assistant too. Right. But especially maybe the African-American assistant who was not an NBA player or was not a star, that you've taken or you've kind of carved a new path for coaches here.
Yeah.
You and a couple other guys.
Yeah, and I've really tried. I carry that weight with you know, that's important to me. It really is that, you know, I do my job at a certain level because I know who I represent. You know, it's interesting because Lloyd Pierce just sent me a great text message after we played him. And talking about that and just, you know, the job that I'm doing and that it helps all of us, you know, and I root for those guys, you know, and we've worked hard to get to where we are. You know, people don't understand that video room is a beast and especially a Miami video room, you know, and so that's why I said that was nothing better could have happened to my career than me going to that video room with Spo. And I think that's where my frustration was at more than anything is when people kept saying I'm a relationships guy. I'm like, wait a minute. I'm a video guy. I'm a video grunt. Like, you know, I'm one of those guys that was in there doing the dirty work, you know, and I went through the whole process the right way. And I'm not just a guy who's going to befriend these guys, but I'm going to coach them and I'm going to prepare them and I'm going to, you know, learn my X's and O's at a high level. And so, you know, that I think more than anything than trying to get a head coaching job was I just didn't want that perception. That's all I was. And so, you know, I carry that weight, you know, with great respect, you know, for the guys that's coming after me. And I try to lay down a pathway for those guys to get their opportunities as well.
Fizz, the one thing, and I, you know, Eric has talked about this in the past about you and anybody who's been around you, wherever you've coached, they call you a connector, that you're able to, you know, even when people get sideways, if Spo and Pat were having a bad stretch, you could be the guy or anybody, that you could be the guy to get in and let's get back on course, like get past stuff and move forward. Where does that come from in your life and how you were raised in South Central LA at a time of tremendous volatility? What was it about that childhood as a young man, as a teenager, that has maybe shaped the way you view relationships and how you interact and deal with people and get past stuff?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously having my grandfather, Robert Hamilton, and my mom, Helen Hamilton, they never let you feel sorry for yourself. It was always, all right, new day, do what you can do to make this day great. You know, you can't complain. You don't have no room for complaints. Your life's better than a lot of people's lives. You know, even when our lives was crappy and tough and we didn't know if we was going to have a Christmas tree and all of the stories you've heard about different people that go through the same type of things, they just never let me feel sorry for myself. And they always tried to instill in me, make whatever situation you're in the best situation possible. And, you know, from there, I moved into me, you know, in my basketball, you know, growing up, I was always a point guard. So, you know, as a point guard, you always had to keep everybody happy. That was what my coaches was always. If something goes wrong on the court, it's your fault. So I always tried to be that guy that was always trying to get us to move forward and to not wallow in problems. And so, you know, I was lucky enough to have really good coaches throughout my life. I'm still close to my junior high coach. I'm still close. My high school coach is my cousin, my second cousin. Both of my college coaches are like fathers to me, Brad Holland and Hank Egan. And so I've been lucky enough to be around awesome coaches. And then obviously once I started working as a coach, I've worked for some awesome coaches. And I think that I was always put in a situation as the relationship guy from that standpoint of you know, when a player was messed up in the head or had something going on, you know, I was the guy that was always sent out to kind of put out the fire. And just over my career, that stuck with me. And, you know, it just, I got to do it on the biggest stage, obviously, when we had the big three. But again, I think more than anything, it was the trust was built because of my work ethic. They knew that I was doing my job, you know, every single day. And so when I did speak up, it was not coming from somebody who was just showing up to be a relationship guy. It was a guy that was investing, you know, hard work into this thing as well. And so, and they always knew that my agenda was always, let's win. I never put anything above winning when it came to being the guy that connected people and pushed people past problems. It was always, how do we take where we are and win? And so, you know, for some reason, it's worked out for me. And again, a big part of why I'm where I'm at is because I got to do it with a group of guys who ultimately that was their number one agenda.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj.
Fizz, we'll continue in a moment, but I want to tell my listeners about Stance. Stance is the official on-court sock of the NBA, which means every player in the league plays every game in Stance. Stance makes an amazing technical sock as well as an incredibly comfortable NBA casual line. So whether the fan in your life plays or cheers, there's something for all of them. The NBA collection features a variety of solid, team-specific, and special event styles, perfect for any basketball fan. And Stance's squad collection showcases styles designed by current players Dwayne Wade, James Harden, Klay Thompson, and Chandler Parsons. By underpinning its creative roots with a relentless focus on technical innovation, Stance has redefined what socks should feel like and the role they play in personal style. Stance ignited a movement of art and self-expression that has drawn athletes, performers, and iconic cultural influencers to the brand, a group they call the Punks and Poets. They include Dwayne Wade, Rihanna, Bubba Watson, Willow Smith, SoCo, James Harden, Chris Cole, and Big Sean. This holiday season, Stance launched its first collegiate collection and stoked out NCAA fans across the country. The collegiate styles make up a colorful collection for devoted fans of every generation, featuring iconic mascot, team logos, and signature school colors. Check out Stance's assortment of gift boxes and sock collections. Cutoff for Christmas delivery is December 20th with overnight shipping. So go explore the newest and best-selling collections for awesome gifts or for yourself at stance.com. That's stance.com, Stance, the uncommon thread. Now more of my conversation with Memphis head coach David Fizdale.
As a young man growing up in South Central at a time is you know, I'd mentioned a tremendous volatility, violence, fear. There had to be days or even moments now where you look back and go, how did I get out of there? How did I? Yeah. You had a lot of brushes with plenty of friends and guys you grew up with and family members did not.
Yeah.
What was your childhood like?
I mean, it was a lot of joyous moments. I don't want to make it seem like it was just totally dark. I had awesome brothers, awesome older brother, older sister. My mom, like I said, she's mom of the year every year for me, obviously, because she was just so, such a pillar of strength. And then I had an incredible grandfather. So, you know, it wasn't all dismal, but it's just the conditions, obviously, of the neighborhood was tough. You know, that was, you know, 83 to 85, you know, crack hit our neighborhood and it hit it hard. And so violence followed, you know, and you just saw a lot of rough things, you know, when you see, you take your trash out one day and one of your best friend's dad is dead behind your trash can from an overdose, you know, and I'm like 8 years old, you know, that stuff, it hits you hard, you know, or you see, you know, guys that you were playing hoop with one day, you know, that night you're running down and you're holding their body in your arms because they've been shot up, you know, young kids, and you're cleaning up brain splatter off your street, you know, with your mom, stuff like that. You know, that stuff, it sticks with you. And there was many days I didn't know if I was going to make it out. You know, there's many moments where I was in the middle of shootouts, you know, right in between my apartment building. You know, I remember when my little buddy Tommy was riding his bike in the middle of Crossfire. And I don't know how I did it, but I grabbed him and his bike, and we all slid under a car and ducked our heads, and bullets was hitting the car that we were under. And, you know, it was many days like that, you know, where drive-bys would happen and we'd be playing tackle football in the yard across the street, and they're basically shooting bullets at where you're at. And so it was many days I didn't know if I'd make it out of there, you know, and, but every day you just woke up and you tried to survive it. You know, like I said, my mom would never allow me to feel sorry for myself or, you know, become a product of my environment. She just continued to be a pillar of strength, and you're going to get your education. You're going to play basketball. You're going to be a good person, you know, and I just knew that if I could just survive, you know, things would work out. And, you know, luckily for me, I had a mom like that, who really, pushed me to be the person that I am today.
You mentioned your mom. She saw the Watts riots,
yeah,
in Los Angeles, yeah, and you lived through the Rodney King riots.
Yeah.
And she wanted you at one point to just, as much as it was dangerous and maybe she didn't necessarily want you roaming and becoming, getting in the crossfire, she wanted you to see at the time what was going on, what it looked like. You ventured out and looked,
yeah,
at what was happening in the city. What do you remember about those few days, weeks in the aftermath? Oh,
man, it was scary because it was, you just didn't know what was going to happen, you know, and I'll just never forget. We were playing a spring league game, at my high school, Fremont High School, which is, if you know how LA works, is my high school is basically on Florence and San Pedro, and we're playing the spring league game at my high school. And literally the riot started on Normandy and Florence, which is probably 5 minutes away, you know, 10 minutes max. And that's where Reginald Denny, you know, was hit with the brick, pulled out of his truck. Tom's Liquor, they started looting the liquor store there, and all hell broke loose. And so I never forget, my high school coach grabbed a microphone at the gym and canceled the game. And he said, hey, we don't know what's going to happen. We just know that fires are starting up. People are looting. Just get home safe. The best way to take home is down Manchester to the 110 freeway. And, you know, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know if we were going to get hurt. I didn't know who was being hurt. I didn't know if people were hurting each other. You just didn't know. It was chaos. And, you know, we got on the freeway, and I would never forget riding down the 110 freeway that day and watching the city catch fire. Cause, you know, in LA, how that freeway sits above, you know, you can see the whole city from up there, and all you saw was fire starting everywhere. And it looked like Armageddon. I mean, that's the best way I can describe it. And so we were scared for our lives. We just didn't know. And so I got home that night and I started talking to my mom, and she kind of really broke it down to me what was happening and what civil unrest meant, you know, and what was going on. And she said, you know, I think it'd be a good idea for you to see what's going on out there. She was like, I don't want you out there doing what they're doing. She was like, but you need to know what's happening and why it's happening. And goes to show you the type of woman she was, you know. And so me and my best friend, Ty Whitehead, we went out, and he lived closer to the chaos on King Boulevard, you know, in Vermont, and over by the Coliseum. And, man, you know, just to sit there and see all of this chaos taking place, it was overwhelming. And, you know, to this day, I'm just really grateful that my mom let me experience that, you know, because now it's shaping who I am as a community leader and a person that wants to serve his community better.
You saw two very different, at different times in your young life, right, very different relationships with the police.
Mm-hmm.
Almost as a younger person, when there was the police athletic league and the police were involved,
yeah,
in taking you to an amusement park or running sports leagues or tournament or having relationships where there was something of a partnership.
Absolutely.
And then to being a teenager in a car with just, you know, young basketball players going to a game and getting regularly, right? Yanked out of your car.
Yep.
Well, you think back to that dichotomy of what changed?
I think crack changed it. I think the violence that came with crack changed it. It put a fear into officers. It changed the way they approached young African-American males. It was now becoming law enforcement. And before, it was just so much more community service involved. Like I was telling my buddies over here that I remember having, you know, officers in the neighborhood where if I was too far from my home and they saw me, they knew my mom, and they would say, hey, does your mom know you over here? And I'm going to let her know that I saw you over here, and you better be telling me the truth, you know, or, hey, do you need a ride home? You know, because we knew each other and it was a good relationship, you know, and that we would exchange baseball cards with our, you know, the officers in our neighborhood. They would come to me, hey, you got Steve Garvey? And, you know, we just knew each other. And it was just so much more of a interaction there, a personal interaction. They were human beings to me. They weren't cops, you know. And we had a program called DAPS where this officer every weekend would pick us up in front of our elementary school and take us on a field trip. And whether it was to a museum or to the state capitol or to Magic Mountain or Disneyland, wherever it was, here this officer was taking his time out every weekend to spend time with us and to show us something or educate us on something or to do something fun with us that we might not have normally gotten to do because we didn't have money. And I think when crack really took a stronghold on our community, it just changed their officers' perceptions of young African-American males. And we all got lumped in together. And it really put a strain on us. It put a strain on the relationships. And, you know, for a long time there, I didn't like officers. I didn't like police. You know, they treated us all like criminals. And for some officers, I think they enjoyed it, you know, because that's why they got into law enforcement, was to be that way. And I think for some, it was fear of their lives and what might happen if I happen to be a gangbanger or a drug dealer on two strikes, you know, possibly on my last strike. And because, you know, they had the 3-strike rule in California. And if guys was desperate in those times, if they felt like they were going to get their 3rd strike, so they were liable to shoot an officer. So I understood that. But as a kid, I was just more of I just had a dislike for them because I just felt like there was no respect there. And it was tough. It was really tough for a long time there going through that, you know, where every time you got into your car with a couple of your buddies, if a cop got behind you, you were getting pulled over. And not just pulled over, but you were going through the whole routine of get down on your knees, put your hand behind your head, you know, lay down in the street. And, you know, where most people just get a routine traffic stop, let me see your license and registration. It was so much more. And, you know, that's why I said now that I'm where I'm at, it would be irresponsible of me to not impact it in some way and try to get it back to what it used to be, you know, where there was real relationships there, where people knew the police officers that were, you know, enforcing the law in their community, getting officers to understand that they have much bigger responsibility than to just police people, but to try to, you know, impact kids long before they ever get to their car. And to do things that try to foster better relationships and look at each other more as human beings and not, you know, as criminals or as law enforcement officers.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj, powered by digital media. Find your voice.
Fizz, sit tight for a moment if you can, so I can tell my listeners about SeatGeek. They've come along and created an amazing app and website that makes it easier than ever for fans to buy and sell tickets. And it's pretty neat how they do it, too. They pull all the tickets available on other sites in the one place. So you save time, and you never miss a deal. You can even set alerts for upcoming events, and SeatGeek will let you know if the ticket prices fall. Even better, every ticket on SeatGeek is ranked based on value, so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed maps to see the view from your seat. I've got the SeatGeek app on my phone, and I use it often because it's simple and because it works. And best of all, SeatGeek is always honest and upfront about the price. They show you the full ticket price from start to finish and never try to trick you with big fees on the checkout page. Now listen closely to this next part because it's real important. My listeners get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. That's $20 right into your pocket. And to get it, all you've got to do is this. Download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab and click add a promo code,
Then enter promo code WOJ, W-O-J. SeatGeek will then send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. It does not get any easier than that. So go support SeatGeek the way they support us here at the Vertical Podcast. Download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code WOJ today. Now back to our guest, David Fizdale.
Guns in this country are available to anyone.
It's sickening.
And now you see, here comes an administration that certainly has embraced the gun lobby. The NRA is now as powerful as they've been at any point in recent history. Is it gutting to you to imagine now where this thing is headed, that there's no possibility here for legislation for anything that can, most of us believe, just common sense?
Just common sense. Well, it's just common sense. I just don't understand what about background checks doesn't make sense. You know, like, how can you not want people to get thorough background checks before they can get a weapon to kill people? You know, I had this debate with a friend of mine who's, you know, a gun guy, and he said, well, cars kill people too. I said, but cars have multiple purposes. It actually transports a human being from one place to another. Assault rifle has one purpose on the street, and that's to kill mass numbers of human beings. A gun has one purpose, and that is to inflict damage on another human being. Look, I get it, the hunters and all of that stuff, but let's be honest. Not that many people in America are hunters. Let's just be real about it. And in the areas that's being devastated by gun violence, very few of those people are hunters. And, you know, I think about what D. Wade is trying to accomplish in Chicago, what we're trying to do here in these other cities. I mean, it's shameful to see the number of kids and people that are dying because at the hand of gun violence. You know, these loopholes at these gun shows, how these guys can now sell guns in bulk out of the trunk of their cars. You know, that's ultimately leading to the death of so many young people. You know, it's just saddening, you know, the fact that people aren't with mental health issues are getting weapons. And, you know, I think about the, you know, they just had the 4-year anniversary of Sandy Hook, you know, and I thought right there that we would see change, you know, because it was like it hit a community of Caucasians and their children. And I said, you know, this can change something now. You know, because it's not just the urban community, the African-American community, the Latino community. This just hit a Caucasian community. This is going to change something. And it just goes to show you how powerful this NRA is and how powerful the gun lobby is, to that the folks in Sandy Hook can't even get people to understand how important it is that we just have common sense legislation when it comes to acquiring a gun and the gun loopholes that. It really disheartens me, and it's saddening, but it's not going to stop me from fighting to get people to understand that we need these things.
The NBA, the platform coaches have, and I think more than any other sport, more than big time, well, certainly more than big time college or the NFL, baseball, Steve Kerr has talked about guns. He lost his father to essentially terrorism. Greg Popovich, Stan Van Gundy have talked out since the election. What is it about your profession, the NBA, that promotes coaches like you in these positions and players to say, I'm going to take a stand that may, you know, like, it's just easier not to, and it's just easier sometimes not to say anything, right? But you guys have done it. What does it say about this league and maybe your?
Because we, you know, I think a lot of our players are living, their families are living in these communities that are really impacted by this stuff. And so when you're a coach of players, you know, who have family that's going through this, you know, that was a hard conversation to have with D-Wade when he lost his cousin, you know. I lost my grandfather to you know, three kids robbing him on the porch and gunning him down. You know, the guy I idolized, you know, a guy there would be no me, you know, in a lot of ways, if it wasn't for him, and for to have him ripped away from me because some kids got their hands on a gun. We live it. It's a real thing for us. You know, Pop coaches those guys. Stan Van Gundy, you know, coaches guys that's impacted by it. You know, his players were devastated by the election. You know, we care about our guys. And so, You know, how can you not stand up as a coach, as a human being, as a man, to not say nothing when you have the platform to impact? I just think that it's, you know, I'm not here to judge coaches that don't say anything. That's not fair of me to do, but I just know that when my time came, there was no way that I was going to sit idly by and not do anything, you know, and I'm not the kind of guy that's going to sit up and just criticize. I'm going to try to put things in place that impacts, you know, and that's why we're doing the Pals League. My wife today is doing a huge deal with domestic violence and fundraising for the women's shelter, you know, and we're working with Grizz Prep, underprivileged youth, African-American youth who now get free education over here. That's, you know, one of the best schools in the country. And, you know, I'm not just going to sit back and criticize and complain, but just like Pop and Coach Van Gundy, we get actively involved. You know, Coach Pop brought something to the Coaches Association this year with the Innocence Project and people being wrongfully accused and serving time in prison, being convicted for things that they didn't do, you know, and trying to help people get out of jail. You know, it just, you know, if Pop's going to lead the way like that and Coach Van Gundy and these guys are going to step forward, then it's my responsibility as a young coach to follow their footsteps and to do what I can to make our communities better, to make the lives of the people that we coach and their families, make their lives better. And so I'm going to step forward every chance I get.
President Obama will obviously leave office on January 20th. You win a championship, you imagine, hey, we get to go to the White House, and you watched it as a kid, right? You watched it as a kid. Like, I just remember the images of, like, the Georgetown team standing there with Ronald Reagan. It's one thing to go to the White House and whoever the president is, but what did it mean to go? And you got to go a couple times.
Yeah.
What was that like for as a young African American man in L.A.? I can't imagine you ever imagined walking into the White House and seeing a black president.
It was overwhelming. It was actually emotional. I got extremely emotional. You know, when my wife and I had some quiet time, I actually got teared up because, you know, I don't know if we ever thought that we would have an African American president. You know, and then it hit me the morning, the first time we were going, I was talking to my mom on the phone. My wife was next to me. And my mom said, do you realize that you're going to meet the first African-American president when you won your championship? Like, and just this incredible pride came over me and just gratitude. And it humbled me big time that I was going to the White House. First, just going to the White House with the group of guys that we accomplished something great. But to me, President Obama will always be one of the great moments in my lifetime, for sure. And to be able to tell my kids and my grandkids at some point that, you know, I got to shake the hand twice of the first African-American president, you know, just, it was very special. And I know it's for all of those guys, you know, we even talked about it, Dwayne and LeBron and Spo. We got to go with, you know, rest his soul, Dr. Jack Ramsey, we invited, which is Spo and I's guy, who we love deeply, you know, to experience that with all of those guys and to know how far our country had came to accomplish that was, it was a special, special moment.
Fizz, listen, you've got work to do here. You don't get many off days in here in the office, but I appreciate you taking all the time out, man. It was great to catch up here.
Means a lot that you came over to talk to me. You got a lot of coaches and people you can go meet with, and you came over here to talk to me, so I appreciate it.
Thanks, Fizz. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Vertical Podcast with Woj, and a big thanks to our guest here in Memphis, Grizzlies coach David Fizdale. Remember to subscribe and listen to new and archived episodes wherever you listen to the podcast, and be sure to subscribe to the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix and the Vertical Podcast with JJ Redick. You can find us on thevertical.com, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, and you can now hear the Vertical Podcast Network every weekday at 3 p.m. Eastern on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, on Sirius Channel 214, XM Channel 203, and on the Sirius XM app on Channel 967. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our sponsors today, Stance, SeatGeek, and Capital One. Be sure to support them the way they support us here at the Vertical Podcast. We'll catch you next time.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.